I decided to use the seven factors of enlightenment for this course. They lend themselves very well to prolonged talks and discussions, and we do have many days that we can discuss them. But not only that, by their name you can tell that they are seven things which one has to practice if one wants to go the Buddha's path. Now, the Buddha's path is the path to enlightenment. There is nothing else. Whatever else we do is only a means for that particular end. There was an article in a German newspaper, because Buddhism is a media affair in Germany at the moment, and it was entitled Meditating More Beautifully, and it was a satire, quite rightly so, and was quite well seen by that journalist, because that's not what it's all about. Of course we have to meditate. Of course we have to be successful at the meditation. But they're all means to an end. And the only end that the Buddha had in mind was what is called enlightenment, nibbana, what you can call liberation, freedom, perfection. You can use any word you like. It doesn't matter. This is another thing that is important also, that one doesn't get hung up on words. Words are the fingers that are pointing to the moon, but they're not the moon itself. And people make that mistake all the time. Creation and creator and God and old man and sitting there and nibbana and nirvana and soul and paradise and heaven and God knows what else. These are all concepts. And if you happen to speak English, that's the ones you use. If you speak a different language, you use different concepts, because they're not exactly the same always in translation. The thing to do is, with words, to treat them exactly as I say. They are guidelines. Buddha used words, thousands of them, in order to tell what to do. But very often, they're also misunderstood. Very often. And they're described and explained in a manner, in a way, which is useless. And people who misunderstand them are usually enormously sure that they have understood them. And argue no end. But what you need to do with the words is to look at and see, what does it mean for me? How can I deal with that? How do I relate to that? Now here's the word, enlightenment. How do I relate to that? Well, the most useful answer is probably, I don't relate to it at all. I don't know what it is. That's right. But then maybe the next answer would be, sounds all right. Maybe I should try. Mm-hmm. And a third answer might be, well, if that's what the Buddha had in mind, and if I really want to use this pathway, well, maybe I should take it for granted that that is the pathway I'm treading. All these are possibilities. The mind can also say, enlightenment, who needs enlightenment? I just want to be a little happier. That's fine, too. But what one needs to do is not try to argue or try to make something out of the word, but if it has some meaning, to see what the personal meaning is. What does it mean to me personally? One enlightened person changes the whole world. And one peaceful person changes the whole world. And there's no question about it. One can feel it and see it and be part of it. See, it's very easy also for us to become aware of that. Somebody is very angry. We know exactly what they're doing. We've all been there. We've all been angry. So we can tell, oh, person is angry. And if we don't fall into the trap of getting angry too, we might have compassion for that person, that they're so angry. But somebody comes in and is enlightened, how would we know? We've never been enlightened, so what do we know about it? What does it feel like? It doesn't wear a halo, hasn't got a badge on, nothing. So we know exactly what we've got inside of us. That's it. That's all we know. And that's why it is so important to enlarge upon that what we have inside of us, so that there's more that we can grasp. We can listen, we can hear, we can read, we can do all sorts of things. And there are innumerable seminars and courses and people advertising enlightenment. I've seen that advertised too, enlightenment. Amazing, absolutely amazing. Yes, it's a real advertisement, isn't it? I think we might have seen it too, I think. And actually, it's very funny, I must say this. I get a real kick out of this sort of thing. I was sent a little pamphlet, or more than a pamphlet, it was maybe an article, by the man who's advertising enlightenment. And he didn't send it, somebody else sent it to me. And the way he talks about it and everything, and what to do and how to do it, and claims, quite obviously, that he has thought about all this by himself. Now, what he says in that article is totally correct. It's perfectly all right. And it's exactly according to the Buddha. But he's never heard of the Buddha, apparently. And thinks he thought it up by himself. So all he needs is a little more time. He's still pretty young. And a little more time to find out that it's all been there. Has been here forever. It's not only this one Buddha. This one Buddha that we are referring to, that's 2,500 years ago. But in our tradition, he was the seventh Buddha. And Buddhas always arise and help mankind in some way. So I found this most interesting, that there is a person who has come to all these ideas, what to do and how to do it, and calls it enlightenment, and thinking he's done it all by himself, and actually it's in very perfect agreement with what the Buddha teaches. But Buddhism, of course, has no place in his explanation. So this proves to me that we are all connected, and we are connected to universal consciousness. There's just no doubt about it. And we can get out of universal consciousness like an echo, that what we already have in here. So if we've got plenty of anger and worry or upset or dislike in there, well, that's what we're going to get out of universal consciousness. There's plenty of that in there. Comes there from all sides. But if we have purity and the wish for enlightenment, liberation, for freedom, the understanding of dukkha, then some of that, what is in universal consciousness, will also come to us. It's like an echo. And none of us, and certainly not somebody who's teaching, and the one that I was referring to, are separate entities able to think all this up ourselves. Nobody is. It's never happened before and never will. The only one that is said to have to think it up by himself is a new Buddha. And the new Buddha only arises when Buddhism has died out. And then the new Buddha has to think up the whole Four Noble Truths and the whole path again by himself, because there's no teacher there. But other than that, there's total connection. And this is an important aspect, I think, that we should never forget. Quantum physics tells us that. Of course, we don't pay any attention to that sort of thing. Who needs quantum physics during the day? But it's actually something which is very important. There are no observers. There are only participants. The observer changes the observed. It's a very interesting aspect. I was never interested in that sort of thing. I mean, physics, I didn't even understand the bare minimum in school. It just didn't interest me. But that is becoming interesting, because it's exactly what the Buddha said. Unity consciousness. It's always there. Now remember that too, for the purpose of this retreat. We're all influencing each other. And that what we get out of a retreat and what we get out of a teaching is 90% that what resides in the teacher and 10% are the words. So never get hung up in the words. It's important to ask, what does that mean? Most of the Buddha's discourses are answers to such questions, like the one I was mentioning yesterday, where I finished the book called the Potapada Sutta. It's a man called Potapada, and he asks question after question. And if he hadn't done so, we wouldn't have the whole explanation of higher states of consciousness. He was totally hung up on higher states of consciousness and absolutely had to know what it meant, and also wanted to know what's the self and why isn't it and where is it and how is it. And the Buddha very patiently answered and answered and answered. So it's important to ask. But it's important to ask, and this is also, I think, a point which in every retreat practically everybody does come to ask so that it's meaningful for myself. What does it mean to me? Maybe it would be a question that somebody else would put in a totally different way. That's fine. No problem. But what does it mean to me? And that's an important way to ask questions. And if one has taught as long as I have, I can tell whether it's meaningful or not, just from the way that's worded. Sometimes questions are asked which are the answers are not even meaningful to that person. And you know what the Buddha used to do with those questions? He either asked a counter question or he kept silent. He wouldn't say anything, because he could see it wasn't going to be, he tells this to Potapada actually, this is not conducive to Dhamma, this is not conducive to enlightenment. And this is what I actually started out with. The whole teaching is supposed to be conducive to enlightenment. And enlightenment means the end of all dukkha. Now people have, of course, misunderstood this, to think of it as if it were paradise, you know, utopia, heaven. Well, it can't be heaven. Anybody who's ever been in a jet plane knows that that's just clouds. I mean, there's nothing there. It's totally uninteresting. It's just clouds up there. So it's not none of those things. It's the end of dukkha, because there's nobody there to have dukkha. It's as simple as that. The simplicity of that does not denote that it's simple to do. It's the most difficult thing that we can do in this lifetime, but it's also the most rewarding. There's nothing that compares with the reward of not being there. Imagine, well, can you? One should, actually. One should be able to imagine it. I compare that to an architect who has an idea how to build a house. So what does he do? He imagines this house and puts it on a piece of paper. And then he can give it to some builder to say, well, look, this is the way I want it, now you do it. Well, this imagination of making a blueprint is very important also in the Dhamma. We shouldn't just say, ah, yes, Nibbana, well, somewhere where I don't know or not understood, or which is true. But we should actually use our mind with as much fertility as it may have to imagine what it could be like to be without that feeling of there's me. If we have been able to do the higher jhanas, actually starting from the fourth, particularly in the fifth and sixth and seventh, we get an inkling of it. Now these jhanas are also part of the factors of enlightenment, and we'll talk about them. But if you get an inkling of it, it's much easier to imagine, of course. But if you don't have an inkling of it, there are some very worldly and mundane situations which also point in that direction, what it's like to be without this me, even though it is very short-lived and very momentary. It doesn't matter, even in one moment. Let's say that we have been watching a sunset, or we've been at the ocean, becoming really imbued and interested and concentrated on the wave movement. Or we've been watching a small child, which is very cute and delightful. And we have felt a great sense of happiness in that situation. Well, let's take a sunset, which is totally neutral and impersonal. Now, obviously, the result of our thinking then is it's due to the sunset, and we must go and watch more sunsets. And so we do, and the next sunset isn't quite as good, and maybe it's even just as beautiful, but we don't feel this great sense of happiness. So we decide, well, maybe it's not the sunsets, maybe it's the ocean. So we'll try that. And the same thing happens over and over again. But what actually is happening there, it's got nothing to do with the sunset, it's got nothing to do with the ocean, has absolutely nothing to do with the small child. These are triggers. Triggers that trigger us into a moment of self-forgetfulness. And when we are triggered into a moment of self-forgetfulness, we can totally give ourselves to the experience. And as we give ourselves totally, even very, very momentary, totally give ourselves to that experience, we have a great sense of delight. And that delight lives within us. It's not there because of the sunset. Because we have seen how many sunsets? Hundreds. Hundreds of sunsets. And if we were, for instance, engaged in driving a car while the sunset was there, we weren't delighted. We said, oh, isn't that pretty? Look over there. And that's it, finished. But that inner complete feeling of actually there's nothing but sunset, there's nothing but beauty at that time, that is only brought about by that self-forgetfulness. So that, even without being able to do any of the higher jhanas, may give an inkling what it can be like when self is no longer the motivating factor. Now, in the world, in humanity, but also in animals, in fact, in all manifestation which is not enlightened, which are many different manifestations, self is the motivating factor. The stronger the self, the more it motivates us, and the more problems we have. If we have few problems, then the self isn't very, not very enlarged. If we have a lot of problems with our surroundings, with the people that we deal with, if we'd rather not deal with them, but like to sort of remove ourselves from them, the self is having a lot of problems. I like to compare that with a very fat person trying to go through a narrow door. If that very fat person goes through the fairly narrow door, they bump the body at each side of the door frame, and it hurts. But if a slim person goes through there, they don't feel a thing. So if the ego is very fat, it gets bruised all the time. Constant problem. And it doesn't need any other person to create the problem. The ego creates its own problem. But if the ego has already slimmed down, then it can easily sort of move in and out of all our confrontations. But being able to imagine what it's like to be without it is a help. The same as it is a help to be able to imagine what it would be like to be concentrated. What the mind conjures up, it can eventually do. We don't have to sit here and wait for the luck or the chance, luck of the draw or the chances that we get. We can make them happen. And this is what the Buddha said. Make it happen. Know what is important and make it happen. And obviously we all have a good enough karma to make it happen. Otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here. People who have very bad karma, they don't come to meditation courses. And if they too do come, which is rare, they'll usually run away after a short time because their whole being is not geared towards this sort of thing. So we have good enough karma. And trying to conjure up what I really want to do doesn't mean that I'm now imagining I'm doing it. Remember the simile of an architect with a blueprint. He's made the blueprint. He doesn't imagine he's already built the house. I mean, the house is nowhere to be seen. But he knows exactly the way it should look. And also he can explain how it should look. So it's a big difference between the blueprint and the actual house. But it's very difficult to build a house without a blueprint. It's sort of potluck. And it can very easily happen that things go haywire when you do. You have to be very careful. You have to really know how you want to do it. So, same goes here. There are 37 factors of enlightenment. And within those 37 factors, the seven are, again, one of them. But the seven factors of enlightenment are more often enumerated by the Buddha than the 37 factors. The seven factors of enlightenment are mentioned quite a number of times, not necessarily with that name. He mentions them over and over again as steps to practice. And as usual, and practically always, it starts out with mindfulness. There's no way we can do anything if we aren't mindful. Now, the word mindfulness is also constantly misunderstood, and we are misled by its simple way of sounding. I mean, what could be difficult about being mindful? Well, actually, it's not easy at all. And mindfulness starts always with mindfulness of the body. That's how it always starts. And in the meditation, we use the breath as mindfulness of the body, and the walking meditation as mindfulness of the body. These are two of the most traditional ways of using mindfulness in meditation. The attention to the breath in Pali is anapanasati. Sati is mindfulness, S-A-T-I. And anapana is in breath, out breath. So what we're actually practicing when we're watching the breath is we're practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, which is the first foundation of mindfulness. And we could enlarge that mindfulness of the body by thinking of being mindful of materiality, of material things which surround us. But being mindful means to be aware and awake, and being very keen observer. And a keen observer eventually gets a different view of what he or she observes. Having really observed, we see it differently. Now, when we observe our breath, and we know we can't live without it, we never think of that, of course. We just say, ah, yes, it's a meditation subject, okay. And or if we get asthma, it's something which is very unpleasant because we can't breathe properly. Or if we should be drowning, also very unpleasant because we don't get any breath. But other than that, we never think of the breath. So now we've got it as a meditation subject. But what do we think about it? Maybe we think, I can't concentrate. Oh, now I concentrated. Oh, my breath is going too fast, I should slow it down. Or, it's too hot to meditate. Or, any number of things. But none of them are on the way to liberation. None of these thoughts. Whether we can concentrate or not, or whether it's hot or not, it's got nothing to do with the pathway that the Buddha taught. When we actually watch the breath, the first thing that should come to mind is, if the mind doesn't immediately become calm, is that our life depends on it. Second thing is, it depends on a completely impermanent intake and outgo of a little bit of air. And if that air should not be pure enough to live in, we die. Which has happened when atomic installations blow up and things like that, and people all over the place die, or bombs go off. So we are dependent upon a little bit of air going in and out. Now immediately it's apparent that everybody else is too. There's no difference. They want the same air, and they want equally as much of it as we do. And they should be given equally as much, otherwise they can't continue to live. So where's the difference? Then when we see this impermanent bit of air going in and out, we can very often relate to the rest of the body as also not being as solid as we thought it was. It's also moving all the time. Maybe we can feel our heart beating. Maybe we can feel our blood pulsing. Maybe we can actually even feel the tiny movements that are ourselves, but they wouldn't say, I am a cell. It would just be a tiny movement which happens, and we could feel that. And as we feel all that, we lose some of that solidity feeling. Now, mindfulness of the body is the first foundation of mindfulness, and because the Buddha thought and said, it was so important. He urges us to always return to it, not only in the meditation, but outside of the meditation. And this is also the reason why I'm using it as a very first item, so that outside of your meditation, when you, for instance, come from your room to the meditation hall, or from the meditation hall you go to the dining room, or you put on your shoes or you take off your shoes, or you get dressed or you get undressed, or you take a shower, whatever it is you're doing, you have keen observation of every movement. Now what does that do? It does many things. The first thing it does, it purifies. The one way for the purification of beings is the first line of the mindfulness explanation of the Buddha. The one way for the purification of beings. Why does it purify? Because if one is a keen observer of every movement one makes, one could not possibly have any hate or greed in the mind. You can't do two things in the mind at once, which is a great boon to us. Although the mind is so fast that we can, of course, change all the time. But if we, through the meditative practice, have had some concentration ability, we can stay on the movement, and we can actually recognize the intention behind it. I'm now going to put my shoes on, and then the actual putting on of the shoe. And as we do that, the mind is clear and translucent and pure. It has nothing that it can be worried about. There's nothing to worry about putting on some shoes. Nothing at all. Neither is there anything to worry about when you take a shower, or when you get dressed or undressed. But what we do instead of being a keen observer of what we're doing, we are maybe putting on our shoes and debating in the mind whether the meditation we've just had was good or bad, or whether we should actually do it this way or that way, and how we could make it better, or how we could remove ourselves from the heat, or how we could solve some personal problem, instead of putting on shoes. Naturally, there's no purification and there's no mindfulness. Everybody does it. The thing to do is to become aware of it. It's really fascinating. We call the mind the magician. It pulls magic, everything, even out of putting on shoes. It's somewhere entirely different. It doesn't have any connection to putting on shoes. It's too easy to put on shoes. And then we walk. We walk, we put on our shoes, we walk to the dining room. Well, since we learned walking when we were less than 2 years old, of course we are very adept at it. So who pays attention to walking? The mind might be saying, I wonder what they're having for lunch. They're not used to vegetarian dishes. I wonder how they're made out. I hope it tastes like something. Or whatever. But who thinks of walking? So when we're hoping it's going to taste like something, or what they're going to do with the vegetarian meals and all that, there is unrest inside. It's not a big deal, it's not a tragedy or anything like that, but it's not peaceful. But if we watch every step getting to the dining room, it's very peaceful. There's nothing to disturb us. What is there to disturb a step? So we make step, step, step. And the mind and the body stay in the same place. There is this New Age mistaken view that mind and body are one. They're not, of course. The mind's the one that has the intention, and the body is the one that's trying to follow it. But they're dependent upon each other, which is a totally different matter from being one. They're two, but they're dependent on each other. And people have made up some sort of fantasy that there's got to be one. Yes, they should be in the same place at the same time. If we take a step, we should be there with the mind too, taking the step. So this mindfulness of the body outside of meditation is just as important as the mindfulness in the meditation, because if we allow the mind to roam wherever it likes, it's very difficult to become concentrated. But if we keep it in check and keep it where we should keep it, it's much easier to sit down and meditate. But not only that, it's a matter of purification and it's learning to be in the here and now. And most people, if not everybody, lives in the past and the future. And living in the past or living in the future is not really being alive. It's memory and it's projection. So if we have a fairly good memory, we bring up things from the past. And I know numbers of people who bring up unpleasant memories constantly. And then they need a therapist to tell it to. And then the therapist doesn't take their memory away either. He just listens to what they're remembering. And the going idea about that is very interesting, actually. The going idea about that whole thing is that you've got to have it clear, all these unfortunate, unpleasant memories. You have to have them all brought up to the present and work them out so that then you can get rid of them. The Buddha would have been quite amazed at such a statement. You get rid of them if you drop them. That's the only way you get rid of them. And the reason why people keep bringing up these unpleasant memories, and there are a lot of dukkha for people, is because they have an ego support system in them. Look at me, how I have suffered. And it hasn't even been my fault. It's always somebody else's fault, naturally. It's nobody's fault, but this look at me, how I have suffered, and it's not even my fault, is a very strong ego support system. It is actually very often stronger than, look what a nice life I've had. People don't usually do that at all. They're very capable of bringing up these unpleasant memories and blaming somebody for them, or for the deed that created the unpleasantness, and don't actually bring up all the nice things that happened to them. So if we must live in the past, why don't we bring up the things which are conducive to joy? It seems that most people find that very difficult. It's interesting, isn't it? And it's no use living in the past anyway. There is one thing to be said about memory, and I mentioned that last night, and I'll repeat it now. We can take a good look at what we are doing each day, and then if there's anything that we find that is better left undone, well, not to do it again. And there we're learning from the past. But to learn from a past which is 10, 20 years back, which people do try to bring up, or 5 years back, or 2 years back, or whatever, is futile. And the person who lived through that experience is no longer alive. We are totally different. So if we use this just the day that just happened, we have a chance. It's useful. Useful to see, yep, there's something there that I don't really want to do again. It takes a great deal of self-understanding and self-inquiry to see that the unpleasantness which happens to us is strictly due to the unpleasantness which we ourselves emanate. Not easy. We always like to find somebody who's done it to us. But it's useless. Totally useless. Do we have any jurisdiction over somebody else? How they feel, how they see us, how they react to us, how they speak? Do we have any jurisdiction over that? Can we hit them over the head and say, I don't like this, do it differently? It's useless, isn't it? And yet in our minds we do it all the time. There's always somebody who's doing something to us. We call it the victim mentality. We are nobody's victim. We are our own victim. We are the victim of our greed, hate, and delusion. And we don't have to be. This victim mentality is demoralizing, extremely demoralizing, because you're looking to the outside world for some relief, looking to the people outside for relief. Well, who's interested in giving relief? Everybody needs it themselves. Everybody wants it for their own. Nobody's interested in giving anybody else relief. Oh, polite, friendly, they say they don't get irked about anything, but relief? It's only inside of us. So we can, actually, what we do with mindfulness. We have the path of purification there, because when we watch what the body is doing, we don't get hung up on the past and the future. And if we don't get hung up on the past or the future, we learn to live in the now. And when we learn to live in the now, we've taken an enormous step. It's the only time we can live. Now. I said yesterday, get one of those digital clocks, or watch one of those digital clocks. It's amazing how fast every moment disappears. I don't have a digital clock, but my son has one, so I've been watching it. And they just disappear. Every moment goes. And as every moment goes, if we have thought of the next one, or the one before that, we haven't lived that moment. It's lost. Most people lose most of their lives that way, in the past and in the future. In the future of what they want to become, and in the past, what they would have liked to have had and didn't have. This is the most common. What they would have liked to have had and didn't have, like their mother wasn't loving enough or something like that. And in the future, they're going to be somebody important. They're going to have more knowledge. They're going to be an excellent meditator. Whatever it is that they're thinking about in the future. But they lose, people who do that constantly, lose their life doing that. Because the life is happening now. And all they're doing is remembering and projecting, hoping and being disappointed. Disappointed about the past, hoping for a better future. So if we learn through mindfulness, and mindfulness can only happen now, we can't have mindfulness in the past. The breath which is gone is gone. We can't watch it. The step that we've done is done. We can't watch it anymore. And we can't have mindfulness in the future because the breath that is yet to come hasn't come, and the step that is yet to come hasn't come. So we've got to be on it now. So if we learn to be in the here and now, we're learning a most important thing. And if we do it consecutively, for several moments, doesn't have to be a long time, just for several moments, we should be able to notice the relief and release that it provides. It's like losing a burden. There's nothing in the whole world that can actually have any connection to unpleasantness within us, to reaction within us, to wanting something. We're just there. We are being instead of hoping to be or having been, we are, makes all the difference in the world. That's why mindfulness always takes pride of place. So to be in the here and now. Now with the body, we have two things that happen. They are actually the one and the same, but we can divide it into two, makes it a little easier. One is the voluntary action, like I'm now going to put my shoes on, or I'm going to dinner.